Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of Mind Power, but we're going to be taking it another level. And how can we do that? Well, it is understanding the interconnectedness of everything in life, number one. But number two, to honor and respect our environment and one of our most precious resources. In fact, in my mind's view, it is the most precious resource because we can't live without it. And what is it? Water. Yes, that clear stuff that seemingly just is, that so many of us take for granted, depending on where we live on this planet. And my guest today is taking it to another level as well. Catherine Ravenwood is my guest. She has put together a book called How to Create Sacred Water. I mentioned this to someone this morning, Catherine. I want to welcome you to the show. And they said, well, it's always been sacred. It has always been something that is so precious. Explain to us what sacred water means to you.
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. And I agree, water is all sacred. All of life is sacred. What has been lost is the connection. As you say, people take water for granted, and people have forgotten that water is sacred. And so my book is about creating what I call a sacred water altar, which allows someone to come into a closer, deeper reverence and communication with the water and come into a purposeful, intentional healing of the water. And in that act, I think that is a very sacred act. And that is why I called it, why the book is called Creating Sacred Water.
Now, your story is an interesting one. You have had so many travels that you have experienced, but Nikki Scully wrote the foreword to your book, and she said that there was an aha moment for her on 9/11, as it was for many, many people, because of the tremendous upheaval that that event created. And she said that she had gone to a wedding in San Juan Islands here in the state of Washington, and she was visiting to you here in the Seattle area. And she said that the water altar, she really hadn't integrated with that. What was her experience, and what was it that evolved a connection so that this particular, what do I want to say, presentation enabled her to heal?
What happened was she and her husband came and spent the night at my house. I was living in Seattle at the time, on their way up to do this wedding in the San Juan. And I had I have an altar room wherever I live. One whole room is dedicated to being an altar. And so she and I were doing prayers together, as we have done many times together. We're sitting in my altar room doing prayers, and I showed her my water altar. And somehow she was stunned. And I think it was just the state of mind. You know, she was not having to hurry around in her own space and get things done. She was in transit from one place to another. And just sitting in my altar room, which is each wall, each direction of the room is dedicated to one of the sacred directions. And so it's a pretty potent room. And as we prayed for the water, I think for her, it was a way for her to reconnect and heal at that time something tangible that she could do. And she ended up creating a water altar in her own home and has since taken the water not only to the ponds on her property, but she takes it to Egypt with her as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's move forward a little bit with you, because you are a minister. You have an interesting title of a ceremonialist. You also are a shamanic guide. You love your teaching, and you have been involved in so many various modalities in your own growth and development as an individual. And you currently are in New Mexico. Am I correct?
I am. I'm in Albuquerque.
Okay, so there you are in a desert environment where water,
yes,
as far as I'm concerned, in that part of the country, water is very, very precious, unlike the Northwest, where we just sometimes feel like we get so much of it, which I'm very grateful for. I call it liquid gold. But
yes,
down where you are, you have long, long periods where you could have no water at all. And so
that's
water
correct.
Has to be managed entirely differently. But let's backstep a little bit to 1999 and something that came basically, it was Hurricane Floyd. Let me just get right to the point. It was Hurricane Floyd. And
yes,
when that hit at Cape Fear in North Carolina, it was devastating. And you had a very special experience relating to that. Share that with us.
At that time, Hurricane Floyd was one of the more devastating hurricanes. Since then, we've seen, unfortunately, worse hurricanes. But Hurricane Floyd was pretty bad. And I'm living in Seattle, having a beautiful experience on a gorgeous fall day, walking around Green Lake, one of the neighborhood beautiful lakes, where there are huge trees and beautiful, you know, birds and just a gorgeous, peaceful atmosphere. And I was thinking about the radio and television reports I've been hearing about Hurricane Floyd. What happened was the rivers had, there was so much water. They had had a lot of rains, and then the hurricane came in, and the rivers totally flooded over their banks. And the water, the lands were completely saturated already, and so there was no place for the water to go, and it just raged through one of the factory farm areas of North Carolina, where all of these chickens and pigs and hogs were being raised in factory farms. And the way that the waste product of those animals is handled on factory farms, at least at that time, was these huge waste lagoons, which were basically fairly shallow pits dug in the ground, lined with plastic, and it was assumed that the weight of the sediments of the animal waste would hold everything in place, and then the water, the liquid, would just evaporate off. When the hurricane waters came through and it flooded, not only were the factory farms themselves wiped out and millions of bodies were washed into the waterway, but all of these sewage lagoons were also wiped out. So we have literally millions of chickens, pigs, hogs floating down the rivers, flooding out over the lands with this massive amount of sewage flowing along with it. And I was thinking, how much is too much? How much can the watershed really heal by itself? I mean, this seemed very catastrophic to me, and it was. It's like, wow, I never thought of this before. How does the water heal itself? And I heard a voice in my right ear say, you know, you could create a crystal homeopathic elixir that would heal the waters of Gaia.
So this was...
So when we see a problem, sometimes we're given solutions.
Mm-hmm. And so this was an aha moment for you, where you started utilizing the talents that you've cultivated for so many years, and knowing that everything is energy, how is it that you take what is seemingly very, very ugly, very, very dark, very, very contaminated, and neutralize it? And I think that that is one of your powerful stories in the book, because it has started you on a journey where you evolve into working with water in that way. And there's so many places in the world where we think, well, I think of a story that I watched in a documentary in 1980 about the River Ganges. And Mother Ganges was just, she's sick, that's what they said, from the pollution. Millions of people, animals in the water, this is a part of the daily life. And there was a Buddhist monk who said, Mother Ganges is ill. She's sick. And she is the life force for so much in that country. And he just was having one challenge after another, and he said, we've got to do something about this. But he encountered many, many obstacles. So here you are in another scenario in another part of the world. We have the same issue in many of the Asian countries. Pollution of the oceans, we have so much of this. So instead of being discouraged by this, you decided you were going to take a different approach. How has your journey evolved?
Wow, it's been an amazing journey because I'm kind of an introverted person, and it was very easy for me to go along in my daily little routine. I was a therapist at the time, treating my clients, doing my prayers, taking care of things. You know, I had a very kind of small circle that I moved through. And this really pushed my buttons. First of all, I had to say, hey, Spirit's asking me to do something. Me, little old me, plain old me. And I chose to respond to that, not knowing what I was going to do. I chose to follow the dots and put the pattern together, which I did. And then I started blessing the water. And, you know, it's interesting you said I used things that I already had. I didn't realize how much of a ceremonialist I had become until I found myself out doing these blessings for the water all by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I just followed this path. And the growth has been amazing to me because it's made me less reticent about what I believe. It's made me more willing to speak out and ask other people to engage and to try and find ways for people to personally connect with their own spiritual calling.
You make a statement in the book, one, learn to listen, be receptive. Two, we are agents of spirit on earth, however free will abides. We will not be forced. It is always our choice. What we choose creates who we become. And this is something that in my many years of working as a counselor and also being a broadcaster and speaker, and when I encountered various individuals, which I've encountered by the thousands, literally, and I always am intrigued by their stories. Because when we're using words, we try to use pictures with our words. We create, we paint pictures with words. And spirit, the higher self, God, whatever term resonates with a person. This is an essence, an energy of universality. And so many times there's divisions because we have a language barrier. With what you're doing and with what you're doing with ceremony frequently eliminates that language barrier. There is something about working with the crystals, with the rocks, and with a sense of just acknowledging and appreciating the life force that we have, whatever terminology you want to use, and it resonates with people. And it is in my observation that this is occurring more and more. In doing what you do, in working with the sacred water, in working with your friends and the people, and you're saying, bless the water, appreciate the water, respect the water, it is having an effect. What are some of the things that you're noticing with what you're doing, with the way people are responding to what you're sharing?
One of the things that has amazed me over the many years is that people are shocked, not everyone, but a lot of people are shocked that there's something they can do. First of all, they have taken it for granted. And they suddenly become aware of their connection with water, and then they realize there is something they can do, you know, whoever they are, no matter what level of spiritual growth they may be at, they're just like everybody else. They get up in the morning, have a drink of water, wash their hands. You know, we all use water. And this is something so prominent in everyone's life that they go, wow, I can do this. it's not that hard. And in that process of making that connection, they start to understand more about themselves. And so it starts with the water. It goes somewhere else. Maybe they realize they can make a difference with, you know, a tree or some person, or maybe they're already doing that and it deepens everything. I think the most important thing is that people find out that they have so much power that they didn't know that they had. And in doing it, that's what we're supposed to do, is turn around and bless life that gives us everything. It is a circle. If we take and take and take and never give back, then the supply eventually runs out, and we can see that all over the world. We're losing our clean water. We've lost clean water. We've lost almost all our trees, clean air, open land. It seems sometimes that just the very spirit of life is being threatened. And if we stop and give back at whatever level we can, wherever we are, it reinforces that circle of life and that flow, and that is our job. We do nothing else. That's our job.
Quantum physics, you say, has clearly shown that our intentions, our focus, and actions do change or alter energy to the purpose of our focus. And I believe it was Dr. Emoto that achieved such international recognition for his work in showing how water is a living essence. And how if And this has been done with plants. I mean, there's so much research on this. It's amazing to me that we have to keep proving it over and over again. But that's life. Every generation has to learn what perhaps they were not taught by the previous generation. And that's what we are going through, it seems to me, at this time, a relearning of what we should already know and understand. But be that as it may, he had photographs. When people stated intention, love or hate, and of course those are very dramatic opposites, you might say, and how it would just be amazing the things that he would find. And if you wanted healing, it would demonstrate itself in this. And when you are talking to people about doing this, when you're talking about setting, just being mindful, being appreciative, and that it will not be wasted. We do this. You actually, when you do your meditations and you work with water that you have, you, like your friend, go and take it with you wherever you travel. And when you do this, you're not taking 5-gallon units here. You're taking little bottles of this. Give a suggestion about some of the things that you do with water and how you pour it out, and what differences you have seen.
Okay. First of all, my water altar, I maintain full moon to full moon, and it's a punch bowl, and it holds a little over a gallon of water, maybe a gallon and a half of water. It has a huge amethyst in it, and I stir it with a selenite wand as I put my prayers and intentions into it. At the end of the full moon cycle, I take that water and put it into small bottles. Mostly I have like 8 to 16 ounce bottles that I've recycled over and over and over with my own personal label on it of blessing for the water. And then I can take these with me. They're very portable. Here in New Mexico, I almost always, where I go, is down to the Rio Grande, because we don't have a lot of sources of water to choose from. And the Rio Grande itself is getting not too grande anymore. It's getting pretty compromised. Mm-hmm. So wherever I am, I go to the water. And I sit down and I sit with the water for a while and just notice what's going on. I listen to the water. I watch the water, the light and the water interplay. And especially here, it's just so wonderful to have a moment where you're just with the water instead of the dry dust all the time. And I see who's around, birds, animals, whatever is happening. And after a while, I take the water out. And I speak my prayers again and say thank you to the water and pour the water from my altar into the river and just watch it flow with the big flow. Now, sometimes dramatic things happen. Sometimes birds fly up out of nowhere or a fish jumps out of the water. Lots of times what happens And the most important thing for me is I get into that flow and I reconnect with, I'm not just zooming around trying to go to my job and get this done and get my to-do list finished. I'm here in the moment with nature, with the water, and I'm part of this. And I watch my prayers bubble down the river. And it's very powerful. It's very peaceful, and it's very healing, not only for me, but when I realize that that's the same spirit I'm offering back to the water, I can visualize the water becoming more clear. And I believe it does become more clear.
Well, and I'm just thinking, if someone is in their home and when they turn on the water faucet and they're taking a shower or anything, you can just be grateful for what you have, be aware of it, and realize that you can do exactly what you're talking about, blessing the water as it is doing its job for you and flowing out.
Absolutely.
Now, one of the things that you bring out in your book, and I'm very much aware of this because of research that has crossed my desk more than once, and this is about chemicals in the water. And
yes,
one of the biggest elements in the water, and you really bring this out, is the pharmaceutical factor that
yes,
have evolved. And nobody was even giving that a second thought. I mean, it just, I can remember years ago, that wasn't something you even gave consideration to. You wouldn't worry about it because you just, you know, if you had old drugs or whatever, hospitals did it, everybody was doing it, you just flushed it down. You didn't realize what was going on. And the Germans were the first ones to recognize that everything that we take in, everything we consume, whether it's food, pharmaceuticals, it doesn't make any difference, it is going to be excreted out of our bodies. And, of course, with our waste material, that is going to, even though it goes through a sewage treatment plant in many parts of the world, and in the United States especially, it's still not extracted. Much of this, they don't know how to get out of the water. There are some things they can, but this isn't. And you mentioned Scott Mickelson, who's in Seattle. He is the chief microbiologist for King County Water Control. And he put out a report, and this is something that I'm sure most people just wouldn't even think about, that caffeine was found in more than 160 of 216 samples of water and at depths of up to 640 feet down. Now, that is
astounding.
It is. It's astonishing. And he said in the Duwamish River, now we're talking about the Pacific Northwest, this is just the area, one automatic sampler in the Duwamish River, which flows into Seattle and empties into Puget Sound's Elliott Bay, measured sewage overflow between 4 and 8 a.m. and another between 4 and 8:30 a.m. And despite the small difference, the second sampler showed total caffeine levels 8 times higher than the first. Now, we all know Seattle is one of the biggest consumers, the population in Seattle, one of the biggest consumers of coffee in the world. And it's all timing. People have stopped off, gotten their lattes, and picked it up. Not that coffee's bad, but we have so many more millions of people in concentrated areas, and this is all being excreted out. Now, you have a Gary G. Coles, and his tests have found measurable levels of prescription drugs, including arthritis drugs, contraceptives, psychostimulants, tranquilizers, and antidepressants like Prozac, as well as cosmetics, synthetic food additives like dyes and preservatives that are excreted down the drain to the pill-popping public's kidneys. Those are his exact words. Now, what's happening because of this? And, Catherine, this is just mind-boggling, but I know it's a fact. I know it's a fact. You talk about frogs. He talked about frogs in Minnesota being turned into sterile hermaphrodites by the estrogen mimic atrazine, and that is a runoff from the farming industry. It was banned in Europe, but it's one of the most widely used herbicides in the U.S. It's associated with birth defects, menstrual problems, and it's widespread in drinking water in the farming areas. Alligators are developing micropenises from estrogen-mimicking pollutants in the water of the Everglades in Florida. Beluga whales in the Arctic Ocean have measurable levels of Scotchgard in their blood system. And most Americans have measurable levels of Teflon and other such fluoridated compounds in their blood. This kind of information being brought out just is a wake-up call. I know in the Arctic where they have dumped radioactive containers, the major nations, U.S., Russia, other nations, putting radioactive containers. I've heard stories from the native Alaskans about fish with tumors, all kinds of things, cancer rates going up. We are awakening to the fact that we can't be sleepyheads about this anymore. So it takes just one person at a time, but collectively too.
I remember being a teenager and in the 60s, and rivers in America would catch on fire. And a lot of people don't remember that, but major rivers caught fire in this country because of all the junk dumped into them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty scary. A couple weeks ago, someone sent me a link to a video that I watched about catfish farming on the Mekong River in Vietnam, and it is blood-curdling. They're having massive of fish farming, and this is the same river the fish farming is going on, and we're talking about tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of farm-raised fish that just are there, and all the drugs they're given, all their waste is going right into this river because that area has become more populated. People have built their little huts right over the river on stilts. Their toilets are a hole in the floor. People are doing their laundry there. They're getting their water to drink there. The children are swimming there. It's become more industrial, and the industrial waste goes in, out pipes directly into the river. And this is something that's happening today.
Mm-hmm.
And it just astounds me that we haven't learned.
Well, and so then there's areas, I think, in Taiwan or Thailand. I don't recall which one. It was an Asian, small Asian country, and they were dumping battery acid into the water.
Oh my
gosh. Honestly did not know that this was going to kill the very life force that they want to have healthy. They don't know. In India, this is going on. In China, this is going on. You've mentioned Vietnam. In Africa, the same thing is going on. And there is so much that's happening around the world, and I think even in South America. So we're not exclusive in the United States, but Europe, they've started to awaken. But they had fires in their water too. There was a time when that happened, when the industrial waste was so horrific, and people were ill. They had all kinds of diseases and things that were carried through water, cholera, all kinds of stuff. Poor sanitation. Poor sanitation. It's just, it's not simple.
I believe it was the Danube reported thousands of dead fish just floating down the river. We don't know why. And the river was clogged with dead fish, and I'm pretty sure it was the Danube. And that was only in the last maybe 5 years.
So this
we're
is
not learning.
Well, we either learn or we're going to die. It's very simple. I mean, and that somebody listening to this may say, gee, Don, aren't you being a bit dramatic? No, it's very simple.
No, you're not.
If you take arsenic, even in small doses, eventually it's going to kill you. So this is something where we need to be aware of this. And we do have the technology. We have the mind power. We have the awareness that we can do this. And that's one of the gifts that I think that your book gives, How to Create Sacred Water. It's not coming from a point of fear. You are saying, be aware, respect, and appreciate this magnificent commodity that we have. This is our life force. Respect it. Honor it. Be mindful about what you do. Take presence with where you are at this moment. Think about what you use, how you're using it, and what maybe little tiny adjustments you can make. And also be aware with your local utility companies and just say, let's be mindful here. This is what's happening. Because we're seeing a lot of things like autism, Alzheimer's. We're seeing a lot of factors that are affecting people at a level today unheard of. And much of it has to do with the very environment that we're in. Catherine Ravenwood, what is your website where people can go and can find out more about your work and what you're doing?
It's www.catherineravenwood.com, and that's K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, Ravenwood, just like the bird and the tree, R-A-V-E-N-W-O-D.
Catherine Ravenwood, it has been a delight. Check out our website, Catherine, K-A-T-H-R-Y-N, Ravenwood.com, and you'll find out more about her work, what she does. How to Create Sacred Water is quite a read. It's a very interesting perspective. And I think you just need to know that you have a lot more power over your environment than what you give yourself credit for. Catherine, thank you so much for being my guest today. I look forward to having you on again when you come out with your next book. Have a magnificent life and keep up doing the good work.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
This is Donna Sebo. We are taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Do you have children between the ages of 3 to 10? Do you love children's books and collect them? Then you'll want to know about God's Kiss, the award-winning illustrated children's book that has been enjoyed by families around the world. 15 beautiful illustrations by Pacific Northwest artist Ed Gedrose accompany this lovely story about a little boy named Johnny that will capture your heart and mind in a very special way. Multicultural and non-denominational in content, it will become a family favorite that you and your children will want to read again and again. This book is available by itself through Amazon, or if you contact me, Donna Sebo, directly, you can get a personalized signed copy. There is also a talking book. You can order the talking book CD by contacting me via email, donna@delphiinternational.com, or by calling 253-582-5604. You can also visit my website, delphiinternational.com, to see more details. God's Kiss is a family classic that belongs in everyone's library. Get your copy now.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone line, if you'd like to call in and chat with me, is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And for those of you up in the far north in the beautiful state of Alaska, I'm going to be traveling to Fairbanks and Anchorage. This coming week, I will be in Fairbanks on the 29th of April through May the 2nd, and then the evening of May 2nd through May 6th, I will be in Anchorage, Alaska. And if you'd like to meet with me privately, call me at my office, 253-582-5604, 253-582-5604. Well, I've got some odds and ends of material that I wanted to share with you today. One is, and of course, you know, if you listen to the show regularly, I feature authors all the time, and I'm a writer myself. Well, it is interesting to know that 75 years ago, the publishing industry was affected dramatically by one man. His name was Robert Ferdegas, and he wanted to change the way people could read, first of all, and secondly, he really wanted to make reading a joy. Now, look at where we are today. We have e-books that have come out. We have these tablets, we have phones where you could read things on your phone, but books are still around, and books are not going to disappear, contrary to what may be promoted. In fact, they're finding that book sales actually are increasing. Now, that may surprise some of you listening, and people like e-books to a point, but this is what this man did so long ago. Now, in America, it was very difficult for the average American to be able to get copies of books. Why? Well, economically, it was too expensive. It was like the wealthy were the only ones that could afford the books. Books were bound and were beautifully done, but the average person with their income just couldn't afford to buy them. So at that time, when 75 years ago, do you know that there were only about 500 bookstores available? 75 years ago. That's all that was in this nation to speak of. And they were clustered in the biggest 12 cities. Now, when you step back in time, costs were different. Cost at that time for a book was $2.50. But in today's value, that would be $40 a book. Now think about that. How many of you would go out today and pay $40 a book? How big a library do you think you'd have at $40 a book? Well, it wouldn't be a big one. Most people in general couldn't do it. So this is what he did. He came up with the idea to launch pocketbooks. He worked with Simon & Schuster. Pocketbooks in May of 1939. It was small, 4 by 6 inches, and it was priced at 25 cents. Now think about that, 25 cents. It changed everything. Why? One, it was portable. It could be taken anywhere. A woman could carry it in her purse. A man could put one in his pocket or briefcase or whatever, a valise, whatever he was carrying. You could read this material anywhere. It was totally portable. People were reading. The increase in reading escalated, just like how email for us. We use email all the time, don't we? There's Twitter that has evolved. And the magazine industry, which, believe it or not, at that time, the mob influence was very strong in the magazine industry. The Gap sold books where they had never been available before. Where was that? Grocery stores, drug stores, airport terminals. In 2 years, 1941, by 1941, he had sold 17 million pocketbooks. That's right, 17 million. They were having a heck of a time keeping up with the demand. Now, there's a historian that did a lot of research on this. His name is Kenneth Davis. And he said there was this attitude that Americans just didn't like to read. It wasn't that. Americans loved to read. They just couldn't afford the books. So when DeGas came out with this little pocket edition, very inexpensive, it took off. 17 million books distributed in 2 years just by the one publishing company. And, of course, other publishers started getting into it as well. And there was quality literature, but the biggest sellers were mysteries, westerns, all kinds of, what would you call, junk novels, romance novels, that type of thing. However, what happened with this is some of the people who we consider our special great authors, like Mickey Spillane's detective stories, Ray Bradbury with his science fiction. Well, what is interesting with this, Kenneth said, is that with the success of the paperback, there also was a downside of it because there were media conglomerates that started buying these pocket book firms, and then they began hiking the prices, and they went after quick-selling bestsellers that they were making good money. And they are, well, now they're not that far apart from your hardbound books. Prices on softbound books are pretty high, too. Mini tablets and e-readers, well, they're fitting in your pocket. And you can have an entire library there. And they're presenting all kinds of new challenges to the publishing industry. And more reading is taking place. But you know what? Reading is not going to go away. In fact, there is a whole different application with it that's evolving. But people still like their books. They like their tablets. But as I've talked with so many people, they said there comes a time when you just want to pick up a book. You have your tablets and you go for that. But e-book sales have been, according to the material I've received, not been as hot as some of the actual book sales are. Why? Well, there's something magical about being able to hold a book. I can tell you I experience it every single day. And e-books, they're not going to go away. They're going to be very popular. Why? Because so many of the pieces of material you can get for a 99 cents. That's a good deal. But there's another side of being able to read something, savor it, and go back to it again and again. A book holds the magic that is unexplainable, and I don't think it's ever going to go away. But one day, well, perhaps we'll get away from cutting the trees and utilize bamboo instead. But there are those changes that are going to evolve because of necessity. And as my guest so poignantly talked about today, we have the understanding of the toxicity of our environment. Well, we need to understand we can shift those components. We really can. But it takes education. It takes communication. It takes a willingness to be able to move forward in new expressions and even making what we have work far better than it ever has before. But it does mean a shift in thinking. It means a mindfulness. And we can all do it. Just one day at a time, one step at a time. We can make a difference. We can also raise our voice to be heard. All of this is exceedingly important. This is Donna Sebel, and you're welcome to call in and chat with me. Telephone number to call in to is 888-627-6008. I am always amazed at the human stories that I come across. And when I came across this one chef's story, it boggled my mind. I love to cook. I'm in the kitchen, and I would never in a million years think of putting my fingers or any part of my hands into boiling hot oil. Would you? I don't think so. If ever you've been splattered, you know how quickly you can get burned. Well, there's a chef. His name is Khan Trishan. And he doesn't use cooking utensils. I've got a picture of him in front of me. I could hardly believe my eyes. This is not a joke. This guy did away with cooking utensils and retrieves pieces of deep-fried chicken from vats of boiling hot fat that bubble temperatures of over 400 degrees Fahrenheit using his hands. I mean, that just gives me the willies. I don't know about you. He feels no pain, and his hands don't show any sign of burn. Incomprehensible, right? He found this ability, oh, maybe about 10 years ago, when he emerged unscathed after being sprayed with hot oil. Now, how in the world that happened? I don't know. But his body didn't burn. And they try to scientifically explain this away. There's something called the Leidenfrost effect, when water on the skin evaporates on or vaporizes on contact with a hot oil. And it provides a protective layer for a short period of time, but they honestly don't know why this man is not affected by 400 degrees of boiling oil. And I'm seeing pictures of it in front of me. And I go, I don't know how he does it. I just don't know how he does it. But he does. One man in a gazillion that's able to do this. Mind over matter? I don't think so. There's something else going on here. What is it? I have no clue. But whatever you do, don't try this in your own kitchen. It is not a good thing. And then an unusual fact about the power of the mind. Well, I'll share another piece of that with you when we come back. This is Donna Sebel. We're taking a break, and we're going to be back in just a moment.
As a counselor, Donna Sebel is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800 872-8852. That's 253-582-5604.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. Telephone number for you to call in and chat with me is 888-627-6008. I love the unique, the bizarre, and the unusual. Why? Because I think life is an exciting adventure. It is with its ups and downs always. But there are so many things we're just not able to explain necessarily in the linear line of logic, although anyone who is very much of that disposition will always say there has to be a quote-unquote rational explanation. Well, I want to step back in time to a particular experience that was had, and this was in the 1800s. Now, again, many of these things seem to reoccur periodically, but I don't have any information about any of this occurring in our time zone, like the 21st century, but at least not right now. However, in the 1800s, in Montreal, Quebec, the people there thought the world was ending. What was the date? November the 10th. Clouds blocked out the sky. The sky turned from a sickly green to inky black. Yuck. My first thought was volcanic explosion, because volcanic explosions can actually create that. We had that happen here in the Pacific Northwest when Mount St. Helens went off. Well, here in Montreal, Quebec, soot began coming down, like rain. They said torrents into the city. There were heavy clouds that rolled in early, changing again the sky from a dark green to black. When the sun could be seen, it was a deep brown. It had with it this really strange, unhealthy yellow color. Then there was a brilliant orange that would show up at times. Sometimes the sun turned a bright red. Vapor was falling everywhere, a very heavy vapor. At noon, 12 noon, everybody had their lights on. Everybody was up because you can see it was really dark. People were getting scared. Now, they were questioning, was there a prairie fire going on somewhere, forest fire, a volcanic eruption? Was this doomsday? Well, you can imagine in the 1800s, and the same would probably happen today, they were expecting the worst. This was not anything that anybody had a clue was going to happen to them. Now, by mid-afternoon, there was this tremendous amount of clouds that were just going over the city very quickly. The sky was pitch dark. And then, according to a report that was published in the Scientific American on May 21st, 1881, there was a pause. There was what they called a hush. Just lasted about a moment or two. And then out of the blue, kaboom, lightning. The sky just was ablaze. Like it was on fire. Tremendous thunder. So loud that everything was vibrating. After that, then there was a thick, soapy, sooty, mucky kind of a rain that fell. After this rain, sky seemed to brighten up for a little bit, and it got dark again. Another intense measure of lightning, and this time it hit the spire of a local church. Fire alarms went off, people running out of their houses, and they stepped out of their houses and they see this black sky, lightning is going across the sky. The next thing I know, the cross that was at the pinnacle of the spire was blasted by the lightning. It fell off of the peak there, crashed to the ground, went into, I don't know how many pieces, slivers, they called it. Next morning, everything was fine. What happened? They didn't find a volcanic eruption. What was it that created this unique batch of weather that was filled with all of this stuff? What was the catalyst? Remember, this was 1881. I know, sounds a little spooky. Good way to start the day, don't you think? Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. And for those of you up in Alaska, I am going to be up in your area in Fairbanks on Monday. And the show will be, we will have two programs that are going to be done on Monday and Tuesday, and that will be reruns because I'm going to be flying. I'll be in the air. I haven't figured out how to do the show from a plane yet. And then I've got an appearance that is going to be happening on Tuesday. But Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday of next week, I'll be back live with you. And you're going to have all the information about my upcoming guest shortly. Just to give you a brief rundown, we're going to be talking about autoimmune cause and cure with Annalise Broccoli, true crime online with Jane Hitchcock, and Kidjacked, Father's Story with Scott Lesnick. Dynamic week, and I hope that you will join me because we're going to have a lot of good things to share. Quickly, before I leave, I wanted to share with you a delightful recipe. And this is a recipe for ginger and orange glazed chicken wings. Now, you can use this for other parts of the chicken as well, but I really would say that this is going to tickle your taste buds. It's wonderful. I love the taste of ginger in food anyway. But this is something you can prepare the wings ahead, and you can marinate them for up to 3 days. I mean, if you really had a big crowd and you wanted to do this, you can do this with this recipe. Here are the ingredients. It's a half a cup of fresh orange juice, a quarter cup of hoisin sauce, 3 tablespoons of fresh lemon juice from one lemon, 1 tablespoon of oil, 1/4 cup of sugar, 3 cloves of garlic, and you want to mash that and mince it very finely, 2-inch piece of fresh ginger. You want to peel it, chop it real fine. It's going to be about 2 tablespoons worth. 2 pounds of chicken wings, and then 3 scallions, white and light green parts only. And you want to thinly slice that. Now, this is how simple it is. Get out your gallon plastic bag. Put your orange juice, the hoisin sauce, lemon juice, and oil into the resealable plastic bag. Add your sugar, garlic, and ginger. Seal it. Vigorously shake it to combine. Put in your chicken wings. Seal the bag. You want to turn it, of course. And you can refrigerate it for overnight or up to 3 days. Is that easy or is that easy? Then when it comes time to prepare it, preheat your oven to 400 degrees. Have a nice big baking sheet. You want to line it with foil. Cleanup will be a lot easier when you do that. Take the wings from the bag, place it on your baking sheet, roast them until they're deep golden brown and shiny, about 35 to 45 minutes. Let it cool a little bit before you remove them from the baking pan. Put it on a platter. Sprinkle it with those finely chopped scallions. Yum. Nice green salad. Goody. Yes, yes, yes. This is Donna Sebo. I'm so delighted you've been able to join me today. Join me next week right here on BBS Radio. and we'll share some more good things for you and, well, just bring you the gifts of so many wonderful people so that your life can be richer with what they want to share and with what I love to share with you. This is Donna Sebo. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a magnificent weekend. I'll be talking with you next week. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.